Hollywood is rated LGBT radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Hey, 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 welcome to this installment of Rated LGBT Radio. Yes, I am your host, Rob Watson. And always, we have a really incredible show lined up for you. As you know, actually, last week's was fairly serious, but, you know, we've had entertainment shows and some of the hot dance music of the summer and shows like that. Well, this one is super serious, and we have a major who's who in the LGBT community online with us on the show. But we're going to talk about the ex-gay movement. And we haven't heard as much about the ex-gay movement in the current political landscape, although I am going to hazard a guess that it is lurking in the proverbial background of what the anti-gay establishment has in mind. But you cannot have a conversation anywhere about the, especially the taking down of the ex-gay movement, without talking about Wayne Benson. And Wayne is our guest today, and he has been at the forefront of exposing all of the hypocrisy behind the ex-gay movement over the past decade or two. And he has written a brand new book called Lies with a Straight Face, exposing the cranks and cons inside the ex-gay industry. And that is chock full of anecdotes and stories and pretty much case studies about that industry and their bad intentions and the bad results that they each ended up with. Many of which he was certainly an instrumental part in, as I said, bringing them down. He is also the executive director of Truth Wins Out, which is the nonprofit organization that has been dedicated to exposing the dangers of the ex-gay movement. He is a former investigative journalist, having worked with WABI TV, and he is a former spokesperson for the Human Rights Campaign. In 1998, he started Truth Wins Out, and in many cases in terms of these ex-gay movement downfalls, it was done with the Truth Wins Out as his back. He's been a tireless critic, obviously, of the ex-gay movement. He's exposed the harmful practices it represents, especially given that none of it is based on scientific evidence. He is an author of a couple of other books. Included in those is a book called Bashing Back, and I think his first book was Anything But Straight. So a lot of history has gone into our conversation today. But before we get to Wayne, I do want to bring on the co-host of the show and the editor of the Los Angeles Blade magazine, Brody Levesque, and we're going to find out what is going on in our world. Brody, what's happening?
Hey, Rob. Well, we'll start with the United States House of Representatives. The U.S. House shot down a procedural vote to move the National Defense Spending Bill forward. The primary reason was that the Democrats all voted in unison because the NDAA has got some nasty poison pill amendments and riders that specifically target transgender and queer Americans that are serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. Ironically, they were assisted by four Republican members of the House who are in direct conflict with Speaker McCarthy. At this point, it is looking more and more likely that the U.S. government is probably going to be facing some sort of shutdown as a direct result on the 30th. McCarthy's pretty much lost control of the caucus. There's also been a bunch of noise coming from the more fringy of what my friend Ari calls the Chaos Caucus, the Freedom Caucus, about unseating McCarthy, which is known as a motion to vacate the chair. So that's apparently also in the works. I've had a couple of conversations with sources in the U.S. Senate who've told me that the Republicans over there are extremely frustrated with the fact that McCarthy doesn't have control of his caucus. They're also frustrated because they need at this point just to get a clean continuing resolution through to keep the government funded so that they can hash out details on some of these other issues. However, the far right contingent in the U.S. House, which is where the spending bills originate, aren't backing down at all. So essentially at this point, we're probably looking at the government of the United States past midnight, September 30, shutting itself down. And, of course, it's anybody's guess how long that shutdown will last for. So, and we're, again, our community factors into it because some of the things that the far-right extremists want directly target our community, and it's just not going to happen as far as the Democrats are concerned. And the Senate has actually sent the word to McCarthy. They want to pass the Clean CR. They don't want to fight either. But they're also not going to pass anything coming across from the House that's got poison pills in it. So it's, as novelist Joseph Heller wrote some 50 years ago, it's a classic catch-22. You're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. Looking around in news, I've got some interesting news. Actor, advocate, writer, film star, and a reading advocate, LeVar Burton, will be the chair this year of Banned Books Week, which starts October 1st and runs through the 7th. This is the first time that an actor has ever served as honorary chair of Banned Books Week. Now, this is an annual week-long event that highlights free and open access to information and brings together the entire literature and book community in support of the freedom to seek and express ideas. LeVar, of course, is probably best known for two things. In 1977, as a very young man, he portrayed Kunta Kinte from novelist Alex Haley's teleadaptation of Roots, the novel. And then after that, he's probably best known for his role as Lieutenant Geordi LaForge on Star Trek The Next Generation and the following franchise. LeVar has been a longtime advocate for reading and reading literacy. He's worked hand-in-hand with GLAAD, who is one of the Banned Books Week coalition members. He's working directly with PFLAG this year. And I think it's really kind of a thing. LeVar, of course, is the host of the beloved Reading Rainbow series. And so this is a good thing to have LeVar in that. This year, the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom documented an unparalleled increase in attempts to remove books and materials from libraries and schools. As you know, here in California, we had a school district that was banning course curriculum because it had mention of a civil rights and human rights activist by the name of Harvey Milk. And because Harvey was openly gay, there were certain conservatives in the Temecula Unified School District that didn't like that. As a matter of fact, the board president in a meeting openly referred to Milk as a pedophile. That brought the attention of California Governor Gavin Newsom, who basically said, you guys will comply with state law. You will educate kids, which includes LGBTQ history because it's mandated. And yeah, pretty slimy douchey to call, you know, Harvey Milk a pedophile, although the governor didn't use that exact phraseology. I did. But the intent was there in Governor Newsom's messaging. So this year, from October 1st through the 7th, is Banned Books Week, and at a local level, we really need some support out there, especially on these school boards. We are doing Mortal Kombat with an organization out of Florida called Monster Liberty, and they are all about banning any kind of literature that talks about our community. So let's get after them, folks. Let's see. Also this week, moving from that, the U.S. Census Bureau has asked the Biden administration to be able to ask test questions on sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, what's unique about this is part of the annual American Community Survey, which the Census Bureau does every year. But this time, the data is going for metrics on ages 15 and older. They really want to talk to the Gen Zers and to the millennials. So there's a lot of focus on that. So they are reworking their wording, and they put it to the White House to get some sort of signing off from the administration on that. One of the things, Lee Badgett, who's an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, was talking to my colleagues at PBS, and Professor Badgett said this: younger LGBT people might not yet be out to their parents or others who are answering these questions as a proxy reporter, so the quality of the data might not be as good for the younger people. Conversely, we anticipate having more information about LGBTQ people than is currently available, including the socioeconomic and demographics of folks who are not in same-sex couple households. Now, that's kind of important to note there, Rob, because the survey in the past, of course, there's been a lot of emphasis on same-sex households because, yep, right, married folks are kind of a little more visible. This year, the Census Bureau is saying, let's take a look at everybody else. So hopefully this will help in assisting in getting some accurate data in on the American Community Survey. And this is one of the things that the folks are looking at to kind of improve things because they're going to be covering metrics on occupational status, industry wages, LGBTQ members who were born outside of the U.S. and have immigrated in, LGBTQ people with disabilities and their families, which is a critical area that doesn't often get a lot of oxygen and probably really should. So the Census Bureau is after the White House to sign off on it. That shouldn't be much of a problem, and away they go. The only other thing of note outside of the usual is, of course, obviously, we're starting to work our way into the 2024 cycle. Once we get past essentially the 1st of November, we're a year out. So we're going to see a lot of push. And, of course, this is a critical election. But beyond presidential, I want to note the following, because this is important. This is the conversations I've had with the Human Rights Campaign, GLAAD, and PFLAG. One of the things that we need to talk about in terms of focus for our community is that there are going to be 40,000 open school board seats in the 2024 cycle. And as I said in an op-ed a few weeks ago, we need to pin the tail on the right jackass. There are two primary targets that we need to think about very carefully in terms of making sure people are aware of why these 40,000 plus school board seats are so critical. The first is Moms for Liberty and their legal counsel, which is some heavy-duty anti-gay. In fact, three of them are listed as hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And a failed real estate agent out of Brooklyn, New York, who runs the libs of TikTok, Twitter, X, however you want to label it, who's constantly stirring up the flying monkey contingent. And we really do need to get people proactively involved. We've got to stop these people getting elected to these school boards. We've got to start blocking this, because when they start screaming parental rights, which is what they're doing, this is their mantra, their meme, their battle cry. The problem is they're only talking about themselves. You know, it's our parental rights, you know, and quite frankly, with the way that they phrase it, it comes off in a really bad way. So, pardon the pun, but we can't let them trump our rights because they think that their so-called parental rights are superior. No, that's not how this works. So as we start to move into the cycle, we start to need, you know, more and more people getting proactively engaged, and we need to start really directly addressing, you know, the folks that are directly responsible for this. And it's Moms for Liberty. They're well-funded. They've got legal consultation that unfortunately is pretty effective. And the thing of it is we really need to stop acting as progressives like we're cats in a parade with some idiot trying to hurt us. We literally need to start thinking about lockstep on this issue. I think the same focus that the gay movement put into marriage equality now has to be put into, you know, protecting the kids and protecting the schools and protecting LGBTQ families, especially the LGBTQ families. Because if we don't stop these people, okay, you know, they will succeed in some places. And here's the thing. It's not just the usual places. We're not talking the red states and the flyovers. And,
right.
That's a given. We're talking about California, Colorado, New York, New Jersey, Washington State, Oregon. We're talking places that, you know, are supposedly LGBTQ friendly and safe houses. And the reality is that's what they're targeting. And here in California, we now have seven, count them, seven school boards who have passed basically instructions to policies that tell their faculty and staff, oh, we want you to out trans kids and queer kids to their parents. Okay. They don't care that the reason those kids may not be out or the reason nobody's been told is because those parents are non-affirming and or in some cases would shove them into, you know, some form of, you know, other issues that would cause probably mental health crises across the board, as our friend Lance Preston has said on the show here before. So, we need to address this, and now's the time to do it. And folks, you know, it can't happen here. Well, guess what? You know, just like those awful mass shootings, it can happen here, and it is happening here. And with that, I'll throw it back to you.
Okay, great. Well, with that, I do want to bring on Wayne, because I want to kind of dovetail what you just described, Brody. First of all, Wayne, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Yeah. So I'm sure you heard Brody's discussion about, you know, Moms for Liberty and Libs of TikTok and all that. I wanted to ask you, because you chronicle the arc of the X-ray movement incredibly well in your new book, Lies with a Straight Face. And the X-gay movement was a direct affront on anybody with gay feelings and trying to get us to convert to being straight. The current mood or the current strategy seems to be with the Moms of Liberty, I almost call them Moms of TikTok, but Moms of Liberty folks, where they are kind of almost going the other way. You know, it's like where they are trying to lock down what they are implying is going to turn kids gay or trans. And, you know, Libs of TikTok is all bent out of shape over everything that has to do with making young trans kids' lives not only comfortable but affirming so that they can transition or they can become whoever it is that they truly are and not get into suicidal and depressive mental health issues. How would you, being kind of our forefather of the anti-X-gay movement, how do you position that X-gay movement with what is going on currently?
Well, that's X-gay messaging, what you mentioned. When they are pushing the message that your child could be altered or changed or influenced by simply reading a book about an LGBTQ person or being introduced to Harvey Milk in history class, that's really the core of that message, that you can change, that people are supposed to be heterosexual unless a malign influence intercedes. And, of course, the answer to that, the religious right says, is to either keep those influences away, is what we're seeing now, or in other cases, when someone's already, you know, says they're gay or trans, then they can go to a program to get, quote, fixed. So it's really part of the same message. And by the way, these are the same groups, many of them, who are behind this, the Family Research Council, American Family Association, Focus on the Family, that are really, I think, driving this. And, you know, you mentioned some of the newer groups, Libs for TikTok and Moms for Liberty. But it's really all part of the same movement. And what they're doing is they're flooding and making it very difficult for us. At one time, they're flooding the entire country, everywhere from more liberal bastions, as you mentioned, like California, to more conservative places such as Alabama or Florida. And it's making it difficult to fight. They also have unlimited money right now. They've had a big injection of money into their movement by Leonard Leo from the Federalist Society. He was just given a $1.8 billion donation from a philanthropist. And this was recent. Within a year. And a lot of this is being funded by that dark money that we're seeing. I don't think the LGBTQ movement is keeping up in terms of financing with all this new money on the right. And I think that's how they're able to have this national campaign. It's being funded. And I think that's something we need to address.
No, absolutely. And it's insidious. And it's just like the abortion issue, where we cannot let them go to the assumption that because things seem to go quiet that they've gone away. They have the ability to lie in stealth for years and years and decades while they build back towards trying to unravel things. I want to go to the book. One of the quotes that is mentioned early on in the book was an assessment of what happens personally to someone who is subjected to, quote unquote, the ex-gay, quote unquote, therapy. And this is a quote from your book, quote, "I was forced to construct a cognitive dissonance that divided my soul from my physical being." Can you tell us a little bit more about that and the effect, the damaging effect ex-gay practices have on innocent people?
I wanted to make the point in Lies with a Straight Face that when the right wing says, oh, we just have conversion therapy for those who choose to enter it, I want to just point out that nobody chooses unless they are under enormous amount of pressure. And the right dismisses it. Oh, it's for anybody who wants it. Well, why would somebody want to change the most beautiful feelings of all, feelings of love, feelings of sexual arousal, unless they were made to feel that these feelings and emotions were evil, that there was something wrong with them that needed to be fixed? And I point out through my personal story the pressures I was under and the pressures to, for example, have a sexual experience with a girl that I didn't want. And a lot of people go through that, because by acknowledging your truth, that you're gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, you will be forced to endure ridicule or in some cases rejection of a family, particularly comes from a more religious background, such as Pentecostal or evangelical. And so I talk about that in my book and point out that when someone says they want to change, you have to ask why. And almost always it's because of lies that are being spread about how awful it is to be LGBT from the right.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I related to that part of the book as well, though I didn't have the specific pressure from an individual girl. I definitely adopted the absolute moral stance of a, you know, no sex before marriage guy, you know, to avoid any sexual contact. So it was like, I'm too moral to have premarital sex. And so that was how I personally was able to hide it. But you do talk about, point out early on, not only are these movements and supposed therapists and all these people that are, you know, trying to get at kids to program them to not be gay, but you talk about do-it-yourself efforts that a lot of people put themselves under. Before we get into these other people, can you go into that a little bit about what happens with people?
Yeah, a lot of people, when they think of ex-gay ministries or conversion therapy, they think of survivors, those who actually went through the programs. And I talk about in the book how these organizations affect a lot more people than the actual survivors themselves. First and foremost, the religious right puts forth that message so they can pass anti-LGBTQ laws, or, as you mentioned a few moments ago, trying to ban, say, books in schools. And the other part of that message that's very destructive is you don't have to go through a program to hear the message. You can see it in the media. You find it online. So the ex-gay message itself is much broader. And so people who don't go through an official ex-gay ministry or have an exorcism or go through this quack therapy often just, as it says, do it yourself. They try it every time they see someone attractive who's a guy, they turn off their mind. Or if it's a woman, you know, they're lesbian, they turn it off. And it's very destructive as well. It doesn't have to be an official program for it to be incredibly mm-hmm. harmful to people who try to change themselves. And that's by far the vast majority of people who are impacted by the ex-gay methods, rather.
Yeah, and I relate to that quite a bit. And it goes back to your quote about cognitive dissonance. When I read that, it was like going, okay, I identify with that. Before I came out, I was very compartmentalized. You know, there was this gay mindset that I would go into occasionally, but then I would leave it to live the rest of my life. And so I think you totally nailed that issue. At what point did you, like I said, you've been our white knight going after a lot of these groups through the years. What was it during your time at the Human Rights Campaign that you focused in on, I'm going to do this, that it became your mission? When did that kick in for you personally?
Well, I talk about that more during my first book, Anything But Straight. And what I talk about is I came out to my parents when I was 18, and they were horrified. They thought I was going to tell them I got my girlfriend pregnant when I told them I was gay. And my dad's reaction was, you still like basketball, don't you? And I'm like, yes, Dad, I do. Thankfully, my parents came around, and they're very accepting. But before they did, we were walking in the mall together when I was 18, and they saw this tape in Walden Books. It was called Gay and Unhappy. It was very strange. The first side of this cassette tape was like an anti-gay Enya. Picture that kind of like soft music with self-hypnotic music. And the other half was this guy with a very deep voice saying, you like women. You like the way they smell. You like the way they feel. And I was mad because I felt my parents were ripped off. They were built out of their hard-earned money at a moment of vulnerability and desperation. Mm-hmm. And they rejected the tape when they asked me, well, what did the tape teach you? And I said, well, the tape taught me that my parents made me gay and they're terrible, that you're the reason. And, of course, my parents were wonderful parents, so they knew this wasn't true. So fast forward many years later, I was just hired at the Human Rights Campaign as a spokesperson. And within a few weeks of me being there, this was 1998, and the religious right, around 15 groups, launched a massive campaign called Truth and Love, where they put advertisements, full page, in newspapers such as the New York Times, USA Today, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, et cetera, all around the country, the LA Times. And the message was, you can pray away the gay or get help through therapy. And they used ex-gays, ex-lesbians to impart this message. And so I was thrust into this, and I already had a problem with these groups because I saw the way it impacted my own family and made them doubt that I was gay when I was 18. So I really wanted to put them out of business. I saw for myself that it was consumer fraud as a teenager, and now I had my opportunity to fight back. I ended up getting involved in it, though, because I was new to the organization, and I hadn't been on television yet. And so people didn't know who I was. So I was able to slip into their press conferences as just some person. You know, they assumed I was on the right. And I would get the intelligence from their press conferences or their meetings. And I was able to take that back to the Human Rights Campaign for our response so we could formulate one. And so that's how I got involved. And what I realized was there wasn't that much information out there to counter these groups. And I started collecting it, and I started collecting stories of survivors and putting out a booklet on that. And suddenly, by doing that, I became a go-to person nationally for that. And one thing led to another. And the culmination of that was the head of the Truth and Love campaign, the most famous ex-gay activist, a man named John Paul, who was the chairman of Exos International, and was on the board of Focus on the Family and also a spokesperson for them, a group called Love One Out. I photographed him in a gay bar in Washington a couple years after the Truth and Love campaign, which was a devastating blow to their movement. I mean, this was the guy who they put on the cover of Newsweek under the headline, Gay for Life with a question mark. And I also outed the second most famous spokesman they had, named Michael Johnston, who was also Jerry Falwell's spokesperson and the founder of National Coming Out of Homosexuality, a play on National Coming Out Day. And we caught him, me and an attorney named Michael Hamer, having motel room orgies with people he met online. And so we took down their two spokespeople that were most famous from that campaign. And they never really quite recovered from that one-two punch. But that's how I got involved in it. I mean, it was just because it was just really, for me, being angry that they exploited my parents when I was 18.
Right. So bottom line, don't piss Wayne off. It's like,
I think they would take, I would think they would take a refund on that X-Game tape at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, was that a bad sale. But I wanted to ask you about John, because you do go into that in the book about, you know, somebody spotted him and called you immediately and you went running to the bar with your camera out flaring. And John is, actually, we did a show on Pray Away, the documentary that John is featured in. A lot of the people in your book are featured in that film that were now out people that were at the time part of the movement and all of that. And John now is a chef and has a partner, and I think you and he and I are all Facebook friends. What is your attitude towards a lot of the folks now that were players in this at the time? Is it all's good, forgiven, or is there some residual misgivings about them?
I think that it's complicated. I find some of these people friendly. I'm friends with them now. We used to be bitter enemies and fight on radio and TV green rooms. We would go against each other and fight on, you know, in counter protests and counter protests. I tried to cover this in the book from a journalistic perspective and lay out what happened. And I understand if people forgive them, and I understand if people do not forgive them. I think it's up to the individual, and I try not to tell anyone how they should feel about that. I mean, how can I tell someone who wasted 10 years of their life and thought about suicide or got hooked on drugs or you know, are the people, the parents of kids who killed themselves because of these leaders, how can I tell them to forgive? I cannot do that. You know, it's up to each person. But my role isn't their preacher, or their rabbi, or their imam. I'm not here to absolve them. I'm not here to sentence them to hell or purgatory either. My role is to keep to keep people from entering these programs, to stop people. My role is to send the message that these programs are destructive, they're consumer fraud, and they lead to nothing but harm and destruction. And these former leaders are powerful at delivering this message, because how can people read the books to change when the people that actually wrote the books are saying it doesn't work, it never works? And there's also something that the former ex-gay leaders can do that nobody else can do. And they can explain why they lied, because the survivor message is incredibly powerful in explaining the harm, but what isn't explained simply from a survivor message or for me is why people say they've changed and swear and go on television and get quoted newspapers saying that they've changed completely and they're attracted to the opposite sex. The former ex-gay leaders, on the other hand, can articulate what was going through their mind and why they lied and why nobody should believe the people coming forth today who are taking their place and saying they've changed. And it's important people understand it. And I think that is probably the power of their message. So I come from it from every different angle. I put forth clergy, survivors, former ex-gay leaders, parents, because each one has a different message and can reach different people, and survivors are part of that equation. But, I don't pull any punches in the book, and I quote them exactly from what they said. And they do need to be held accountable. But at the same time, I think that some of the former ex-gay leaders are trying to make amends to the extent you can. Again, you can't bring somebody back who committed suicide, but they are committed to spending the rest of their lives saying this does not work. And they can't bring people back, but maybe they can prevent people from experiencing these programs in the future. And I think that can be productive.
Yeah, I think that's amazing perspective. I love what you just said. And I totally get that, because, I mean, I do remember back in the day, I absolutely remember holding that Newsweek edition that had Pollock and his wife on it. And just, you know, especially at that time and where everybody was, you know, because being gay wasn't that accepted and all of that. And it was horrifying, because it just really... It set up a conversation. It set up something that I knew in my life I was going to have to try to defend in some way that I knew was a lie. I mean, I knew looking at the cover that was not true for them. And you talk about that in the book, about the absurdity of all that. I do want to jump ahead, though, of another historical moment.
I just want to quickly add that not only did you not believe it, knew it wasn't true, I make it clear in the book that the religious right themselves knew it was not true, and they didn't care because it was about passing anti-LGBTQ laws. Former ex-gay leader Yvette Cantu-Schneider was candid. She said the right never cared about what happened to the young people affected by this who might have wanted to commit suicide or had. And they also didn't believe that gay men could change, but it didn't matter. About the truth didn't matter. It was about passing these laws, and this was all just it was just all public relations for them, and a message at the expense of actual real human beings. And that just goes to show, it's an indictment of the far right and their lack of empathy and humanity for people who call themselves, you know, Christians. I can't think of anything less quote Christian than the way they put forth this message, and they knew it didn't work behind the scenes. They would say it.
And that's a great point, and it goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. That is an absolute through line of what they're doing right now with trans kids. They don't care that they are sending trans kids into deep depressions and that suicide rates are going up and crises that they're creating now. They don't care about that at all. You know, they are just so caught up in their political dogma. I mean, it, you know, excellent point.
They're saying they want to protect the kids, but whose kids? They say that they represent parents' rights, but which parents? Clearly not all parents, not all kids. They really don't care about our kids or the parents of our kids.
No, and even the kids they're claiming they're helping are probably kids that they're hurting anyway. Because, you know, there are kids in those Christian families. Last thing they need to do is have their parents repressing their perceived sexuality. I mean, you bring up one person in the book that I actually have written a column about in the past before, too, is little 8-year-old Gabriela Fernandez, who was killed by his parents because they perceived him to be gay. You know, they're absolute horror stories, and this moms I keep wanting to call them moms of TikTok again, but moms of Liberty and libs of TikTok and all those don't care one bit. I want to ask you though about the other part of history that you played a hand in and had an effect, was on the Michelle Bachmann presidential campaign with you and your associate John Becker, and John also has been on the show before. Tell us how what happened there and how you kind of orchestrated that downfall.
Yeah, that was the fun part about writing a sequel. With Live with a Straight Face, we went further than the first book. The first book ended in 2002, and it was still a big question mark about these ministries, what would happen to them. They were still very strong. In fact, they hadn't reached their heyday yet. And so my first book was 2003. So 2006, 3 years later, and after Polk was exposed and Michael Johnston, 3 years after that, George W. Bush had ex-gay leaders, Alan Chambers and Randy Thomas from Exodus International at the White House. So this was still, you know, raging. So it's fun to get to tell what happened after that, the fall of all these groups in the new book. And part of that, we tell the story of Michelle and Marcus Bachmann. Michelle was running for president, and believe it or not, she was gaining traction. And for those who might be younger who don't remember Michelle Bachmann who are listening, she was Marjorie Taylor Greene before Marjorie Taylor Greene. She was the original. And she was incredibly homophobic, and her husband, Marcus Bachmann, is just as crazy and perceived by many in terms of stereotypically to possibly be gay in terms of mannerisms, to be quite blunt. And they were obsessed with this issue, and she's running for president now, and she's actually gaining traction. USA
She won the Iowa caucus, as a matter of fact.
Yes, exactly. Michelle Bachmann was gaining steam. So when she started to be taken a little more seriously by journalists, the truth wins out, my organization starts getting calls. Hey, what about this rumor that Marcus Bachmann's practicing ex-gay therapy? We didn't have an answer to that. We weren't sure. We suspected. And there was only one way to find out, and that was to actually go to his clinic in Minnesota undercover. And John Becker was my communications director at that point. And we decided at a meeting, the organization was based in Vermont for a few years, and we went out for, you know, maple pancakes and had a discussion, and we decided to go in. And we bought the undercover gear, and John went and erased his online profile so he can be tracked and so forth. He went undercover for 4 weeks to Bachmann and Associates and proved that Michelle and Marcus Bachmann were lying, that in fact conversion therapy was part of their clinic. And it broke originally, I believe it was the Nation magazine, and then ABC News picked it up. And it was Brian Ross picked it up, and then it went everywhere. It was comedians are making fun of it. It was a very massive blow to the ex-gay industry because it became a joke. That's the best you can do when you get the late-night comedians making fun of them. There is nothing more, I think, damaging to them than when that happens. And that's what happened with when we exposed them to practicing conversion therapy.
Yeah, it was classic, and it was important to just show the underbelly. It's sort of like, you know, we all know what's going on. We know what they're doing. But, you know, the fact that you guys went in to document it and verify it, more for the edifice of everyone else who wants to give it a pass, you know, super important. One of the things, and I'm sorry to jump around because I want to hit you with some of the key points. The book is excellent, and everybody needs to get it and read it and absorb it because apart from giving a very astute history of the ex-gay movement, it also gives you the philosophical origins of where they're coming from then and now. One of the things that you do discuss in the book is the fact that even though there have been legislations in numerous states, and I fought for the first one when it happened in California originally, but there are legislations against quote-unquote reparative therapy for minors. You point out how that isn't taking care of the job completely, that what is the shortcomings and the the things that we need to be looking even deeper in that, that it's not eradicating the problem.
Yeah, I support these laws. I think they send a great message. I think they get a lot of really good media. But in some senses, they're symbolic and haven't really shut down any ex-gay ministries or you know, conversion therapists. And that is because it's very easy to hide behind the First Amendment, especially in the direction the court is going right now, with people like Amy Coney Barrett and Samuel Alito in the Supreme Court, and say, you know, one day you're a conversion therapist, and the next day they pass a law, and suddenly you find God and become a Christian therapist. And then you're able to pretty much do conversion therapy under the rubric of religion. And so they're able to get away with it. There's a loophole big enough to drive a semi through. And so while I testified on two of these bills in New Jersey and Massachusetts, and I support very much these laws, we have to remember that it doesn't end the problem. And sometimes I think they're presented as a panacea, as it's a ban. And so people just do the check mark. And that can be very damaging in the same way when I worked at the Human Rights Campaign. One of the most damaging problems we had is that people assumed that it was illegal to fire someone for being LGBTQ. So it was made it more difficult to pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And the same thing here. We have people who believe that, oh, we passed this law in our state. We don't have to worry. Well, you know what? California was, passed this law, I believe the first. And California has the largest ex-gay ministry in the country right now called Change Movement. That's part of a cult church that has 11,000 members and it does over $60 million annually. And it's very slick, this Change Movement. It's very impressive in terms of their marketing. And so this is happening in a state where these laws are passed. So I think those laws are great, but I think the most effective response we've ever had wasn't a law. It was a lawsuit brought by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Truth Wins Out and myself participated in helping find plaintiffs at the beginning of the suit. And the lawsuit was against a group called JONA, which stood for Jews Offering New Alternatives to Homosexuality. And it was based in New Jersey, the lawsuit, and a jury found them guilty of consumer fraud and shut them down. They had to close their doors and turn off their website. That was the most effective of all, and I think our movement should consider more lawsuits, consumer fraud lawsuits, and the reason is they can't hide behind the First Amendment and say, oh, we're religious. Well, it doesn't matter if you're religious, if you're committing fraud. You're making promises you can't deliver and delivering disasters you never promised. So I think we should focus in the future more on these laws, particularly after the 11th Circuit just overturned some of these conversion therapy laws, for example, in Florida. And a couple of conversion therapists in Florida actually were paid damages, and six-figure damages. So they were actually paying these quacks because they, quote, took away their First Amendment rights, which I think is, by the way, preposterous. I mean, we're talking about medical regulation. It's not regular First Amendment. These judges are any of these judges that are ruling this way, I think are incredibly misguided. You can't, for example, be a heart surgeon and give someone a heart surgery and say one day after surgery, you know what, I think it's great if you eat three Big Macs a day and fries. Well, because that's malpractice, right? You can't – it's speech, sure, it's words, but it's also very damaging. And if somebody did it, an actual surgeon did that, if a cardiologist did that, people would want their license yanked. You can't say, oh, it's just words. And I think the same goes for conversion therapy.
Yeah, especially if they said, you know, don't take your heart medicine, it's going to be God's will, you know, and this is my medical opinion. It's like, no, that's your religious opinion. And yeah, no, point well taken. One issue that I've written about and has been not that the conversion therapy stuff isn't ugly on its own, but even a deeper ugliness to me is the fact that a lot of people who are involved in these programs are essentially repressed gay men who are in denial about their own sexuality, but in the process of exercising these programs are playing out their own sexual stuff, usually on people who are confused and dealing with their own sexuality, and that there's a lot of abuse. You allude to it in when you're talking about journey into manhood and their retreat. There are things there, and there are other parts of the book where you touch on that. But I wanted to pull that out as an issue. How do you see that issue, and do you see it as predominant in these ex-gay, quote-unquote, therapies?
Ex-gay ministries and conversion therapy are recipes for sexual abuse. As you've just pointed out, you have a bunch of repressed counselors, ministry leaders, therapists who are gay themselves and fighting their own demons, so to speak, in these private settings with vulnerable people who are looking to them as authority figures. And it's a uniquely vulnerable position. And we saw that, for example, in the Jonah case when we put them out of business with a Southern Poverty lawsuit. Southern Poverty Law Center lawsuit. In that case, we had two men, Chaim Levin and Benj Younger, among others, who were made to undress in front of a mirror and fondle themselves. And we have seen in other occasions, for example, the International Healing Foundation with Richard Cohen and Journey into Manhood as well, which is also called Brothers Road, these hugging sessions. It's non-sexual touch, they call it. Are you serious? You have a guy who is gay and they're having 20-minute hugging sessions? I mean, in the world I come from, that's called foreplay.
Right.
And there's a lot of delusion going on with the counselors themselves, and that's why we've seen almost every single major ex-gay leader come out of the closet or be scandalized, because they don't change. They're just as gay as their clients. We've seen so many examples of sexual impropriety. The other group that was large for many years, Homosexuals Anonymous, was the second largest next to Exodus International. Their leader was Colin Cook, a Seventh-day Adventist minister. And he was fired because he was having mutual masturbation sessions and naked massages with the people he was trying to cure. We had an Exodus. We shut down, my organization helped shut down a ministry in Michigan, Corduroy Stone. They had a counselor who was giving these massages, these touch sessions, and they gave it to a former...
Uh-oh. Well, it looks like we just lost Wayne. It just disconnected.
Well, if he was on an iPhone, there's a good chance that that was a premature battery failure.
Oh, maybe, yeah. So, we'll see if he is able to call back in and we can conclude. One other thing in the book, and I'll talk about it in his absence, he does talk about the Freedom March. And, Brody, I don't know if you remember that, where I think it was several years ago, they declared that July was going to be ex-gay month because of June being, Pride Month. And at the end of, quote-unquote, ex-gay month, they were supposed to do this Freedom March. And the first one was an beyond embarrassing failure. There were literally 12 people who showed up. And they, they had predicted this was going to be March on Washington. I think Wayne has joined us again. That was a huge, huge, huge failure. Wayne, welcome back. We thought we lost you.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. Love the technology. My point is, over and over again, every single leader has been engaged in every one of these organizations in sexual impropriety because you're uniquely vulnerable and to these people who present themselves as experts. So, for example, if they say, oh, we need to take off your underwear, it's part of the program, people will do it because, this person – They say they're the expert. They've written a book. They must know what they're talking about. So they do it. And people are regularly taken advantage of. I would be talk about, you know, they talk about LGBTQ people, you know, they accuse us of, quote, grooming. That type of stuff is actually what their worst fears is going on in these so-called ministries and conversion therapy.
Yeah.
If I was a parent, I wouldn't get my child within 100 miles of one of these organizations. It's a recipe for not only failure, but sexual abuse as well. It's something that's not it's not a bug. It's a feature of these groups. I think we have enough evidence to say that confidently.
Yeah, great point. It's like that's even people who are anti-gay, it's like I would want them aware that your son is likely to be sexually abused as part of this process. And, you know, because it is all done from this feel of people. And unfortunately, we are running short on time, so I want to do some of the house cleaning. How do people get the book, Lies with a Straight Face, number one? And number two, how can they support Truth Wins Out and your continuing efforts?
Well, first they could find the book and a link to purchase on WayneBesson.com. That's WayneBesson.com. And it's available right now for pre-orders on Barnes & Noble, and you can also go and get it for Kindle, the book. It's going to be available soon on audiobook, which is quite a story in and of itself for another day. So the audiobook will be available as well. We need help fighting these ministries. They are flush with money. They're becoming more aggressive. In fact, they went to Washington, D.C., and were bragging about speaking with dozens of lawmakers. This group Changed had done that. And so you can help us counter them at truthwinsout.org. That's truthwinsout.org. And we hope you'll support us, and I hope you'll buy Lies with a Straight Face. And let me know and what you think of it. If you do, I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, definitely go out and buy it. It is destined to be a book banned in Florida and other places. You know, it's a badge of honor, I'm sure. But you need to own it and get it out there. Please do support Truth Wins Out. Wayne, I want to thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for writing the book. But more importantly, I want to thank you for being you and what you have done. When are these histories are finally written 100 years from now, your name is definitely going to be in there as probably the forefront leader against this horrible scourge of ex-gay ministries. You have been there as the David to its Goliath time and time again. And so we as a community owe you a deep debt of gratitude for being you and the fight you have undertaken for us. So,
Thank you. And that's why I wanted to write it, because we're in an age of censorship and historical revisionism. And I wanted Lies with a Straight Face to write the truth to ensure that future generations know fact from fiction.
Perfect. And that is what we are all about. And thank you so much for being here today with us on the show. And with that, we have to conclude. We will be back again next week with another great show. I have no idea what it is, but Brody will tell me sometime this week. And I can guarantee you, though, it will be a great show. Also, read the Los Angeles Blade. It is the publication you want to read every single day. New and unique and high-quality journalism as authorized by GLAAD itself, and you can find that at losangelesblade.com. For those that us at Rated LGBT Radio, we'll be back and talk to you again next week. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!